Ring bell. Ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling. Let's roll the tape. My name is Pete Steinke. The title of this session is Anxiety, Shame, and Guilt. Yesterday I shared with you Margaret Mahle's schema for human development, particularly the development from infancy up to the age of 4 and 5. Today I'd like to add a little bit to that and also look at particularly the emotions of anxiety, shame, and guilt. And what does this mean for who we are even today as adults? During the period of symbiosis in which the child and the mother is still like a dual unity, one complete physical entity, though the child is beginning to do some differentiating from the mother, if the child, developmental task, if the child does not attach to the mother, learn to attach, even as it begins to sense its differentiation, the child will have the fear of abandonment. Right before Christmas, I lost the hearing in my left ear. And after going through the first treatment, which did not work, the ear specialist said, well, you will have to have an MRI because sometimes the arteries are closed by small tumors, especially in males. And he set up a date for me at the imaging center. Well, I didn't even know what an MRI was. I thought it was an instrument they'd put in my ear or something. Until one of the therapists in our office said, oh, an MRI. She says, they put me in that thing, and I couldn't even stand it for 15 seconds. I had to get it out of there. Then she said, oh, I apologize. She says, I've set you up for this. And I said, yeah, she did. Well, all I knew is they were going to put me in a tube, so I started practicing at home underneath the covers and underneath the couch just to see what it would be like. Well, none of the anticipation could match the actuality. I walked into the room at 8 o'clock in the morning. The technician was a very good professional, and I looked at the machine, and he could see already from my face the anxiety. And he says, well, we're going to put you on this bed, we'll lift you up, and then we'll slip you into the tube. And I want you to know that both ends of the tube are open. I don't know why that was important to me, but that was really important. And then he said, I'll be able to talk to you, and you will be able to talk to me. And that was very important. And I just stood there, and I didn't make any motions. And he says, well, I can see you're anxious, and I understand that. He says, why don't you give it a try, close your eyes, and think you're somewhere else. Well, I was determined to find out whether I had the tumor. I had already gone through the trauma that I had lost the hearing in my left ear, and I would never regain it. So I thought 47 minutes. He said there'll be a 12-minute period, then a 10-minute, 6 minutes, 6 minutes. Well, as it turned out, it was a little bit longer than that. But what I want to get at is I'm in there with my eyes closed, and you can't move. They even press the sides in on you once you're inside. If you have claustrophobia, you're finished. I kept my eyes closed. I preached sermons. I made telephone calls to people. Everything I could think of to do to keep my mind off of where I was. But at the end, it was completed. And it came a voice and said, now stay still, and I'm going to take you out. But the voice was a female voice. Now, the thing I most wanted to do is to get out of there. And I said, where's the man? A very primitive fear of abandonment. This was the individual whom I trusted, and he wasn't there at the end. And she said, well, he's on the phone with the doctor. I said, well, why didn't he stay here till the end? Later on, I couldn't believe myself that I'm arguing with this woman about where the man is, and I want to get out. She takes me out. I walk towards the door, and I catch him out of the corner of my eye. He's on the telephone. And he said, nice job, you did real good. Well, he was okay after that. But then we were back into some kind of relationship. But you could probably recall a number of experiences in your own life where is the man? Where is this person? This deep sense of the fear of abandonment. And very primitive. Now, developmentally, if we do not learn how to attach, to overcome this fear of abandonment, we tend to become later in life fusers. Or as I mentioned yesterday, enmeshers. I was kind of interesting because the fuser is the one who clings and clutches. This is more like the borderline personality disorder. The one is very clingy. Now, I, in my own relationships for a long time, was a fuser. So I know that I have this deep fear of abandonment. That's part of who I am. Now, in the next period, the separation period, if one doesn't differentiate oneself from the object or from mother or the primary caretaker, there is this fear of absorption. You will totally suffocate me and absorb me, and I won't be able to get away from you. The tied to mother's apron string, the killing with kindness kind of phrases that we use. Because the need here is to be able to separate. When one cannot separate, one then becomes an isolator. One distances later in life. Because the fear is, if I get close to you, you will absorb me. As here, the fear is, if I get close to you, you may abandon me. It's very usual, normal for isolators and fusers to join in marriage. Like I said yesterday, you could have two isolators who get married. One can live in Los Angeles, one in California, or maybe they both live in the same house in Oshkosh but never talk. You could have two fusers. And this happens in the codependent-dependent relationships. It happens in incestuous families. It happens in those families that are most dysfunctional, where you have great amount of fusion. Because where you have the greatest amount of fusion, you have the most susceptibility to anxiety, and it takes the longest period to recover, too, from the anxiety, from the fusion. In March, I spoke to the ELCA bishops and to the head bishop and his entourage from Chicago for 4 hours on relationships. And I was talking about the Bob and Betty marriage, and I said, as an example of the fuser, and I said, Bob and Betty is one word. You don't know where Bob begins and ends and where Betty begins and ends. They're all stuck together. Well, after I gave the presentation, one of the bishops called me over and said, I'd like you to meet my wife, Betty, and my name is Bob. Then she said, we've had, at one time, a Bob and Betty marriage. I came out of an alcoholic family, and we know what you were talking about. But that's what I'm talking about here, the fuser and the isolator. Now, let me just do a little digression here. A marriage relationship, if you have a fuser and isolator, that's wonderful, because each one is containing the opposite for the other. The problem becomes when one is totally the fuser and one is totally the isolator. Then the marriage becomes very dysfunctional, because in most functional relationships or emotional systems, you need to be able to be flexible in the roles that you assume and play out, in the functioning positions that you take. Clergy often complain to me, I do all the work. You know, lay people just don't help. Well, they're working 80 hours a week. They're over-functioning. What can they expect other people to do? If you over-function, what's going to happen? The rest of the folks are going to under-function. Yeah. My wife's here, you know, and there are times when she wants to have the house clean. And she'll go for 2 hours and get that house clean. And then she'll come and say to me or to my sons, you know, nobody's helping me. I'm doing it all. And I will say, well, honey, you're over-functioning. No, I don't say that. Or, you know, I would say, you know, I'm trying to keep the budget, you know, and everybody's spending the money. Now you got to help me. And here I am over-functioning. And what did it mean for everybody else? Their role then is to under-function. That's when you get dysfunction, when somebody over-functions while the other is under-functioning. So if one is always the fuser or one is always the isolator, you've got dysfunctioning. Okay, we move on to this. In rapprochement, we said the need for the child is once it has separated is to reattach. But the fear is I'm going to lose the object if I separate too much. So I'll move away from mother, but then you watch children, they'll just make sure that mom's still in eyesight. Because the fear is the loss of the object. Now, I need to be able to reconnect. These are all very normal gestures or postures or movements in the psychological life. The need to attach, to be close, yet the need to be separate, then the need to reconnect. Now, if I do not complete this task very well, I have a lot of problems with ambivalence, of fence sitting, of neither being here nor there. In object constancy, the fear is the loss of the love of the object. Here it's just the loss of the object. Here it is the loss of the love of the object. I need to be able to internalize the outside object, the primary caretaker or mother. And so that mother is still present even though she's absent physically because I have a mental image of her. So it's very true that what the self-image is often built on the other image. I need a good image of others that I can internalize, which then also helps me develop my own self-image because my self-image comes out of the primary caretakers that I idealize who are outside of me. Now, if I don't internalize well, I become a splitter. And I mentioned yesterday that this is the most primitive defense we have against the traumas and the difficulties of life, is to divide the world into black and white, either or, good or bad, in order to put some order into life. Power competition, here it's the fear is of punishment. I do something wrong or bad, I violate a set of values. The task is I'm able to relate to people rather than just to compete with them. If I only learn how to compete, that means the task is still uncompleted because I have to learn how to relate and live with other people outside of the primary caretaker relationships. Well, I'm going through that very quickly, but what I want to mention here now is that there are certain feelings that begin to emerge during each of these periods. The most basic human feeling is to be anxious. It is built into life. And it is during this early period here of autism and symbiosis that we have the fear of abandonment and absorption. And underneath all that is just the fear, element of anxiousness, of anxiety. It is in this period of separation and rapprochement, moving towards the object constancy, that one begins now to learn shame. In Eric Erickson's schema of human development, you may know that he puts autonomy versus shame during this period. Autonomy is that time to become separate. Now, shame has to do with who you are. I want to distinguish that from guilt, which develops later on here when we get into the competitive stage, because guilt has to do with what you do. Guilt has to do with values. You violate a value by your actions. Your mother says, don't steal a cookie, and you steal the cookie, you feel guilty. Now, you may also feel shameful, but that's a somewhat different concept. Shame has to do with who you are. Your whole being is at stake. I'd like to make a distinction by putting some items on the board here in terms of how to distinguish anxiety, shame, and guilt. If you excuse me for a few minutes, I'm going to be a little didactic. But anxiety is the loss of calm. No longer the nice oceanic feelings of the womb. No longer this sense of being totally one. There's a loss of calm. Shame is the loss of face. And guilt is the loss of integrity. I violated something in terms of my action. Let me emphasize something about the loss of face. Ralph Keyes wrote a book called Chancing It. And he talked about why do people take chances, risk. And he talked about risk level one and risk level two. And most of us are at risk level one. We'll take certain kinds of risk. But then he talked about the family that does the high wire attacks, Evel Knievel and all these people who take these major risks. And in this study, what he discovered was These people did not take these tremendous risks to increase sensation, but to avoid humiliation. The number one fear in all of life, Key says, would be the fear of humiliation. He said the human being would rather lose limb before losing face, would rather lose life before losing dignity. That's a part of the element of shame, the humiliation, a loss of face, a loss of identity, a loss of who I am. Oh, by the way, I forgot to give you this little cartoon. This is from Matt Groening, Life in Hell. Have you ever read his cartoons? This is from Chapter 4, How to Be a Turbulent Two-Year-Old. Now, that's in that separation rapprochement period. It comes from a book called Childhood is Hell. There's a little tyke there, and he says, I am an individual. The universe revolves around me. I have a will of my own. I make decisions. I have amazing powers that I never suspected before. I assert myself. And remember I said yesterday, during this period, the child feels like king, omnipotent. Now, the next section. On the other hand, I'm just a little tyke. The world is big and beyond my control. I have limited capabilities. I am quite annoyed. My wishes are ignored. I am quite frustrated. Perhaps I am deluding myself. I am plagued with self-doubt. I never realized before how truly bad I am. I am so ashamed. And then there's a little note below. It says, repeat through adulthood. All of a sudden, this grandiosity and then this recognition, our self-abnegation, this loss of face. Okay, anxiety has to do with the feeling of one's vulnerability. I just don't have control over life. Shame has to do with exposure. When I'm into shame, I'm exposed to you and I'm exposed to myself. And it's that sudden onrush of being exposed. Guilt, on the other hand, has to do with condemnation. Anxiety has to do with the loss of being, this sheer dread that I will not live. This has to do with the fear of rejection. And now there are a lot of shame-based families. And the way you get children to obey or to fulfill your needs is to shame them. I have a client whose mother never said to her, I am angry with you, but would say to her, you're a disgrace. You're a shame. You're no good. She denied her own feelings, then projected them onto her child, and her child now is beginning to deal with the issue of her shame that's been hidden for so long in her life. Here in guilt, it is the fear of judgment. I will not be seen as being good because I violated a code. When we have anxiety, there's a lot of paralysis. It's just paralyzing. Here, it's just plain humiliating. I am exposed and people see what I am. And here, in guilt, I feel very small. Now, there are some very good things about each of these feelings. I just don't want to mention the negative things. I want to stick in here something that is very positive. For instance, anxiety creates attention. I pay attention to things I never paid attention to before. Now, the value of this is that if I don't have awareness, I don't have choice. I need certain awareness to make choice. But as long as I am in a fantasy or I'm into inattention, I don't know what's going on, I have no choice. This does not mean that if you do become aware, you're going to make the proper choices. It simply means that you can't make certain choices unless you have awareness. Shame is good because it creates discretion. And we see that in the Garden of Eden. What did Adam and Eve do? They closed themselves. They went into what we call discretion. They had the fig leaves. And over here with guilt is guilt gives us new direction, gives us a sense of responsibility where we need to go. So these feelings also have some very positive connections for us. Any questions here before I go on to the next section? Is there some clarity here in terms of what I'm talking about in terms of anxiety, shame, and guilt? Ken?
Yesterday you mentioned that when you use the word object, you're talking about people.
People, yes. Okay. Anybody else? You will notice that anxiety is rooted in being itself, just life. Whereas shame and guilt is rooted in our relationships. So it's not until we get to this period that we even experience shame or guilt. Our earliest experience is almost overwhelmingly anxiousness. This is not to say that at any particular time we're going to feel one feeling and not the other. Usually under stress we go through a gamut of feelings. But you can usually tell that you've regressed pretty far in a trauma when you're getting back into shame and anxious feelings. That these are very, very primitive feelings. And under stress, we all do some kind of regression, moving back. Okay? Any other questions, comments? Now, in the Lutheran Church, which of these three feeling states or affects have we emphasized the most?
Guilt.
Very good. Wasn't much contest there, was it? Paul Bosch said this morning, he said he had a friend who was a Roman Catholic and became a Lutheran, and he says, boy, since I've become a Lutheran, there's all kinds of vistas of new guilts. And the old way of preaching was, if you can make somebody feel guilty enough, then you could preach and announce the gospel. Okay. That was Luther's problem. Excuse me.
Just one question. I mean, I guess as I look at Luther's church, I don't want to say shame sometimes. I mean, I look at the confessions, we talk about poor, miserable sinner that I am. And that sounds more like shame in a way, if you find it.
That could be shame for someone who already had gone, you know, that was the message at home, that you are poor, miserable.
Poor, miserable sinner
is something else, yeah. That doesn't say you're a poor, miserable person, which would be more shame. But I know what you're saying. It could have that connotation. That was Luther's problem. Luther was beleaguered by his guilt. And so in a lot of Luther's writings, we come across guilt words and guilt language. Okay. Now, I would say 90% of the clients with whom I work are beleaguered not by guilt, but by shame and anxiety. In fact, I have a friend who is not a Christian, but who said, I would rephrase the words of absolution in your worship service. He's attended Lutheran worship services. He says, after confession, I would rephrase the absolution to be, I forgive you the guilt of your sin in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. And I announce to you God's complete acceptance of you as a person in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Because shame has to do with who you are, has to do with acceptance. So if I were looking at the gospel being addressed to these three conditions, you have forgiveness to be addressed to guilt, right? There was no sin until what? The commandments were given. Until there was a set of values. There was a criteria over against which you could evaluate your behavior. Shame has to do with God completely accepting you in spite of who you are. God's great nevertheless. It has to do with your whole being. Anxiety. The gospel is addressed to anxiety, I see, as hope, as shalom. There is a wholeness to your life, even though you may not fully experience it. Or maybe the essence of God's providence In spite of the dread that you experience as a creature, there is a creator who is in control or in charge of this world. I believe we need to address issues of shame and anxiety in equal, or maybe even at this point more so, than issues of guilt. Now, what is interesting is in the scripture there are 35 references to guilt and its cognates, whereas in the scripture there are over 180 references to shame and its cognates. In you, O Lord, have I trusted. I will never be put to shame. Beautiful statement, say. I've trusted you, Lord. There's faith. I will never be put to shame. I will never be unacceptable. I will never be rejected. I will never be abandoned. That's the message. Look through the scripture. Get a concordance and look at the references to shame. Some people say this is because the scriptures are more an Eastern document than a Western document. And it was the Western world that emphasized guilt, particularly the medieval period, as opposed to the Eastern world where the emphasis is on shame. When Cain kills Abel, Cain's face fell. What's the picture? Shame. I feel little. I feel overwhelmed. When Adam and Eve, the great fall, they have to then hide, right? God has to come after them. Where are you? They don't want to be exposed, correct? So they hide. Because the great thing about shame is you're exposed. And also, when you're exposed, you're isolated from other people. When you're feeling ashamed, you don't want to be seen, and you don't want people to see you. So shame has this powerful, stinging, isolating effect to go along with its exposing effect. It's even difficult to listen to people talk about their shame and their shamefulness. We don't like to listen to it. Okay, any other questions or comments? Yes?
Are shame and guilt actually different qualitatively, not just quantitatively? Like, I've been trying to figure out what the difference is, and what I've come to is they just seem to be different.
Well, guilt would say, I am immoral. Shame would say, I am inadequate. Does that help you?
Yeah, somewhat.
Okay. Because somebody may feel immoral, and because they feel immoral, then feel inadequate. They have the same effect in that one gets a sense of littleness and overwhelmingness. But what I want to say is guilt is what we feel more when we do something in violation of a set of values. There are no values in shame.
Okay.
It's just me. My whole being is at stake.
So the feeling is the same as sort of a cognitive
description. Well, I think some people can be in shame and they may not necessarily feel guilt. Because what happens, the thing I want to mention here about shame is we begin to internalize shame. See, and then when we internalize that shame, we feel as if we are little and we are worthless. And we begin to belittle ourselves. It would be, except for the expression, the face fell, for the Hebrew would be the humiliation, the humility, right?
I was brought up as a Catholic when I was a child. And before I went to confession, I had a lot of anxiety. When, you know, we go to individual confession, and I was really ashamed of what I had done. But once I had done my penance, I had no more guilt. You know, I was finished with that particular thing I did wrong.
Once you did penance, it was finished.
Yes, I forgot it. I felt I was forgiven.
Mm-hmm.
And started with a clean slate.
See, and actually, though, penance has to do with
guilt. That's right.
It's to take care of the condemnation and the judgment. And if you do the punishment, I mean, you do the penance, then this will be removed. But with shame, is there's nothing you can do to remove it.
Making the confession, you know, kids don't do so much harm, but you confess everything. So I felt really ashamed when I was on that other side of the confession. I thought, oh gosh, you know. But then as soon as he gave me the penance and I said my prayers or Hail Marys or whatever, no more guilt, no more anxiety for that particular space.
Till the next round.
Till the next
round. Yeah, okay. Yeah. See, once you get with that shame, it's my whole self, my own inadequacies, and how do you forgive you for being an inadequate human being? You can forgive you for killing, you can forgive you for forsaking the Sabbath or whatever, but how do you forgive somebody for being inadequate? And once they begin to internalize that shame, their own inadequacy, they begin to live that way. Very often they have to cover up that shame, that humiliation, because the one thing shame doesn't want again is to be. Go ahead. Why don't we internalize? We can internalize guilt. We're always afraid of what we're going to do, so we don't act. We don't take risks. We don't make decisions. Because I may make the wrong decision, and I'll be judged and condemned. Okay. This is, I really don't even let you know who I am. I hold myself in, because I'm taking the risk of exposing myself. And you could reject what I've exposed to you, my epiphany that I've made known to you, whatever.
But you still might act, but you'd act in that sense of a false self?
You act in the sense of a false self, yeah.
So the guilt makes you very inactive, and shame might make you even more active.
More inactive and just inadequate. You just feel totally inadequate, yeah. And it's hard to be motivated when you feel inadequate to make kinds of decisions and so forth. Yes.
Isn't my shame is that you might recognize or someone else might recognize my guilt, of which I'm already aware.
You may. But you'll also, shame has to do with, you'll recognize my limitations. You'll recognize my boundaries. Let me give an illustration of a blaming situation. Father driving the car. God damn it. The gas gauge must be broken. Why didn't you tell me it's been off? Mother, what do you mean, me tell you? Father, well, you drive the damn car most of the time, don't you? Mother, but you're the driver. Why didn't you stop for the gas at the last exit? You should have known it would have run out soon. Father, what do you mean I should have known it? Why didn't you tell me to get off the exit? Very odd, different behavior, but very normal behavior. Yeah. The blaming that goes on. And what's the effect of the blaming? To shame someone, to belittle them. Okay. To give them the sense that they're inadequate. But in the process, what do I get out of it? I feel like I am adequate. I get a positive identity by giving someone else a negative identity. By the way, the name of this book is called Shame, by Gershon Kaufman. I would say this is the classic on shame. This is the book if you want to do any reading on shame. Another hand, yes.
It seems to me that that's not true, that I don't get a feeling of adequacy when I'm shaming another person. If I really had a sense of adequacy, I wouldn't have a need to shame somebody.
That's correct. Yeah. Well, you try to relocate the fault, but you really haven't dealt. That's right. You're correct.
But don't you feel guilty? I mean, I'm blaming my husband for not having gas. He's a little too close to home.
Take it slowly.
But then I feel guilty for having gotten upset about it.
That's what I'm saying. These feelings can happen in multiples. They just don't easily divide themselves. You can feel shame and guilt. And you can feel anxious all at different times, but in a cluster. All I want to make the point here is that shame is a sense of inadequacy, as opposed to guilt, which is immorality. And this can stay with you no matter if you've done anything or haven't done anything. This is the way you view yourself, how you see yourself, becomes your self-image. And I deal with so many individuals who are here at the shame level. They're in touch with guilt. You know, because bishops will sometimes say to me when I'm dealing with a pastor who's been involved in a sexual affair, you know, have they confessed their sin? I said, hey, they know the sixth commandment. They are already, I've already felt guilt. But what are they struggling with? Shame. I've been exposed now. See, people see who I am, and what do they feel? Tremendous isolation. I, who should have known better, I, who was clergy, should not have been involved in this. Tremendous sense of shame. Now, some of them get into blaming. The church is abandoning me. Nobody cares about me. God's forgiven me. The church has forgiven me. Well, those are all shame issues, see. I'm not here beating them over the head with the law for guilt. That would be poor therapy. That's already doing its work. I mean, they've been Lutherans so long, it's got to do its work. But this is the issue that they're at, and I'm saying that, you know, you've got to take to the bishop saying, this is where I'm working with them. And I think you have to recognize that that's where they're at, too. They're feeling tremendous, tremendous shame. And, of course, there's going to be a lot of anxiety because if they have to resign, their whole income and pension and whatnot is gone and up in the air at the same time. Yes? Mm-hmm. Yes, it is a natural response. And we all have our own way to do it. See, we've all find our own ways to defend ourselves against this. You said you get pacing?
Well, at one time I was in great grief. I mean, it was just free floating anxiety. Just didn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And I had
I know when I'm anxious, I can't sit still, and I talk fast and a lot. And somebody else may do it, may not talk at all, and may get into a catatonic state and not even move. I don't know, but we all develop our own ways to do that. Shame, I just want to hide. The bigger the hole and the stronger the cover, you know, so nobody can see me, fine, just get me out of here. Guilt, I feel kind of small, looky. Everybody has their own kind of way, and anybody else knows what their behavior is when they feel guilty or shameful or anxious?
The other thing that happened with that was that I was sure that no one wanted to be with me, that friends that should have been supportive I couldn't trust. So I suppose that's the shame thing.
That shame, the isolation of shame.
Yeah.
Yeah, you get isolated. Okay. Yes. Correct. The key is always, how do I handle my anxiety? How do I handle my shame? Our first tendency is to focus on other people or to focus on external causes. And the key to health is to focus on yourself. I'll always say to clergy who come and talk about alligators and dragons in their church, those are very telling words. It's very reactivity in very just using those words. Let's say they are people who are opposing the pastor. I don't focus on the antagonist. I say, why are you hooking into this person's reactivity? The key is your own. Are you reacting to somebody's reactivity, or are you responding? Are you thinking out your position? Are you determining who you're going to be, or are you just automatically reacting to somebody? See, for most of us, we kind of just automatically react. We don't stop and think or take thoughtful positions. And we need to do that. I'll tell you, I want to diagram that for you here in a minute. This is our brain, or make believe it's our brain. My wife's the artist, not me. And Paul MacLean has talked about the triune brain. The smallest part of the brain is the reptilian part. And it is in the reptilian part of the brain that controls behavior. The second largest part of the brain is the mammalian part of the brain. And this is also called the limbic system, or controls the limbic system. And this has to do with feelings. It is also in the limbic system where the nurturing aspect comes in life, and the playing aspect. Reptiles do not have a brain portion to do the limbic system, so they don't even care for their young, because there's just an absence of a limbic system. The largest part, I'll just put CC, is the cerebrum cortex. And this is where all the images get formed in our brain. And the cerebrum cortex is like a massive a tool shed, where you've got all these tools in there you forgot you even had. Or it's just a massive collection of images. Let me give you this example. When I was 5 years of age, I had a German Shepherd dog chase me up a tree. I was traumatized. See, all basic learning is through experience. Because the inductive method is the most primitive form of learning. We don't learn the deductive method until we get into school, become 5 or 6 years of age. And then when we become adolescents, we learn the seductive method. No, I'm only kidding. But all early learning is inductive. I learn by experience. All right, now, here I am on this limb, on a quince tree, about this high, and a German Shepherd dog is just escaping my buttocks. But I'm traumatized, crying my head off. Okay. Finally, somebody chases Mrs. Magnuson's dog, was even the dog of a Lutheran lady, can you imagine that, away from me. But in my cerebrum cortex is an image, German Shepherd dog. In my limbic system is freeze, and I still freeze, probably give off an odor when a German Shepherd dog comes. My behavior, you know, is just, I feel fear and freeze. Now, when I started a new congregation in Virginia, I did the canvassing, went to house and had a little notebook. And if anybody had a German Shepherd dog, I just put a note in there, GS. When my mission director came and looked at the book, said, I noticed there were 7 GSs. He asked me what the 7 GSs stood for, but maybe Good Shepherd or something. I said, Jack, that means these people have a German Shepherd dog, and I don't care if the kingdom of God ever gets there, I'm not going. Images attach to either pleasure or pain, then determining behavior. Okay? Now, what happens so often in life is you have the original event, and we form some kind of a defense or coping mechanism or adaptation to deal with that threat or that trauma. But the event passes away, but what happens? This stays. Gets imprinted in the brain. Kind of interesting in sports psychology today, more and more coaches are using films of techniques, how to do something. Even skiing, they'll do this for skiers and golfers. Watch the pros do it, because it can get imprinted in the brain. And then it can be translated into the rest of one's life. I have a lot of friends who are in a behavior therapy, and they always say, yeah, but, you know, we have the greatest amount of change with our clients. And I say, well, you should. You're working with the smallest part of the brain. You see. This is key, because Scripture says, be ye transformed by the renewal of your mind. Repentance is to change your mind, change your images. It's very difficult. It's easiest to change behavior. Next, it's easiest to change feelings. The hardest thing is to change the images that got imprinted from the experiences. Excuse me.
So images never disappear, though, do they?
Never disappear. They're timeless. They're always there. Go ahead.
You can put new ones in.
You have to get new images. In fact, there are some people who say, I will never really be able to deal with a German Shepherd dog until I have a new experience with a German Shepherd dog that will create some pleasure. And then I will not try to escape the German Shepherd dog. Yes, it can. Or you can have a new event in which you do new coping, new adaptation, which replaces the old. But let me say this. The old is hard to jettison. The old returns unless you keep practicing the new.
But isn't that also a self-preservation part about us to preserve that? Because if you lose the new, you can still rely on the old.
Well, yes, that's true. But sometimes the old is dysfunctional.
Oh, yeah. But yes. I mean, this is without thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. We would rather stay with what is familiar than to risk the unfamiliar. Even if it's painful, it hurts, and it's dysfunctional. It's familiar. There's this resistance to change. I'll talk about that more when I talk about emotional systems and the resistance to change and the psychology in that. Yes?
Could you just follow prejudice through on this? How prejudice works? Because they always talk of that as one must be rooted
in prejudice. Somehow or other, some images are formed of particular people or whatever, which are associated with pain or pleasure, which then provoke certain kinds of behavior. I imagine if you were, you know, you live with Archie Bunker, you'd have gotten certain images over and over again, correct? And you would have internalized those images, and they would have been associated with certain feelings, which would have created certain behaviors.
And so often they aren't based on a real life experience.
Wouldn't have to be, correct.
And it's amazing how strong it is.
As long as some image of another group was constantly reinforced over and over and over again. Yeah. See, and I think this is important for us then in terms of learning. One way we help people learn is to keep producing new images. See, to add to the old images. And that's also growth, isn't it? That you now, part of the growth of the mental process is that you can resource any number of images in order to perceive or understanding life. And if you don't change your images but keep staying with images, you really lose a lot of growth. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Even if you don't have the experience.
Could be reinforced, just verbally reinforced, correct.
I think that the easiest to change would be behavior, and yet I would think that that would be a temporary change unless the images were changed. The only way to permanently change behavior would be to change the images.
Okay, let me say this. This is a system, so if you can change one, you can change all. In other words, if you can change behavior, you can change some of the feelings and you can change some of the images. Or if you change some feelings, you could change images and you could change behavior. You get what I'm saying? It's a system that one will impact the other. There's sometimes I can get a new image of myself when I try to do new behavior.
When we're discussing civil rights, one of the defenders would say, well, you can change the way people behave, you can never change the way they feel.
I don't agree with that.
Well, I know you don't, but yeah. The point they were making was if we force people to change, then their images and feelings also have to change eventually.
Somewhere along the line, right. But again, anything new has to be reinforced or you go back to the old. And that's why it's very important for us to do, you know, the Sunday liturgy. It's a reinforcement of who we are. And through that reinforcement of who we are, we discover who we are and who our being, and it keeps our life intact. All right. Yes.
I've heard that if you try to change the behavior, something similar to another question, without changing the energy, it's a constant struggle to get back to the old behavior. If you don't work with the image, changing the image, and just put your nose to the grindstone and try to change the behavior, they
well, it could be, but once I change my behavior, see, I'm coming back this way. I'm having a new experience of myself, which can create a new image. Okay. There was a time when I was a junior in high school and I had to give a public speech. I was terrified. In fact, that's the number one fear of high school students, you know, that speaking in public. Soon, almost the number one fear of people in general. That has a lot to do with shame, I think. Here I am exposing myself. Well, I certainly have changed because I love to talk to groups. I mean, to see where I was at 16 and where I am today at 36. No, I'm cheating. it's a dramatic change. Somewhere another, I changed behaviors. I had to speak, and it created a new self-image. I see this in clients, working with clients, especially with clients who are non-assertive, to encourage them to do some assertion of self, to take I positions, to make I statements, and for them to begin to change that behavior and stop being the doormat of the world, they begin to change an image of who they are. I see that happening. But it takes time. You know, the kind of image we have today is that human nature can change overnight. But see, we can change certain things historically by technology. But we do not have the technology to change human nature. We're part of nature in itself. And nature has its seasons, its rhythms, its cycles. And it just takes time for us to change. It's not like putting a piece of paper in a Xerox machine, pushing a button, 2 seconds you got your solution, right? You got your answer. I just totally disregard anybody who promises you salvation over a weekend or a new life in 24 hours, unless it's medication that can have that effect. But it just takes time. We have to repeat the new behavior in order to overcome whatever it is the old behavior we want to get rid of. Well, I actually didn't want to get on Paul McLean's brain or triune brain here. I wanted to lead this into something else. And how much time do I have? Just 5 minutes? The child, when the child comes into life, the child is full of eros. The Greek word for eros is vitality, life energy. Unfortunately, in Western society, we have made eros represent just sexual energy. You know, eroticism, erotica, etc. Sexual energy to the Greeks was libido. And eros and libido are different. Eros can use libido in its service. But libido infrequently never uses eros. Eros always wants to attach itself to something. Libido will attach itself to anything. So in essence, when you're in love, it's eros, which may use libido. But when you're horny, it's libido. I don't know how else to put it. That's the difference between the two. See, you can have eros without libido, but eros can use libido in its service to make the attachment good and pleasurable. But libido will attach itself to anything. And I always remember this. Eros wants a specific attachment. But what happens to eros in life is our parents say, you cannot be this and live in this house. The socialization process is a part of disowning parts of yourself. It just happens. We probably are instructing our children to disown the things that their grandparents disowned and our great-grandparents disowned. It just kept on going. All right. Then what happens is we're told to disown these parts and not be this. All right. Let me just do this quickly. How about mind? Anybody remember anything their parents told them not to be? Some message? Don't ask so many questions. You're driving me crazy. So what happens? What do you disown? Your curiosity, your imagination. Anybody else? Remember?
Don't be an artist.
Don't be an artist. Okay. Don't use your right side of your brain. Quit dreaming. Yeah. Get rid of your imagination, your fantasy life. All right. How about feelings? Don't cry. All right. Anybody else? Don't get angry. Don't be this. You can't be this and live in this house. How about body? Wear clean underwear. You may be in an accident. Huh? Don't play with it. See, mother is all excited about her sexuality, so don't play with it. You know, they did a time study of mothers changing diapers. And if the child had its hand on its genitals, the mother would move the hand first before attending to taking care of the rest of the needed stuff. We can pass on this uneasiness of our own to others. And we tell them to split it off, disown it, don't be sexual. All right? This can also happen in body, mind, feeling, actions. There's certain things don't do, right? Don't slouch. Don't walk so slow. Don't what? Don't run in church. Okay. Then there's certain things about spirit not to be. Right? What are you supposed to do when you go to church? Be quiet. Yeah. You don't celebrate. You don't express yourself. Be quiet. Anything else? Real somber when you go up for communion. Okay. Don't move. Don't move. Okay. I was always afraid I was going to have a religious experience. Because I was always warned about the schwärmerei and the enthusiast. You know, that we always had to make everything objective. You couldn't feel anything. So I was afraid I was going to feel something. By the way, Luther helped me a lot in that. He says, you know, faith is not determined by feelings, but faith can certainly feel. All right, this is disowning. And when we begin to disown parts of ourselves, we then begin to look for a partner somewhere in life who will match up with us, who will not have disowned some of the things we have disowned. And that becomes the beginning of romance, and we really feel great and whole and good because this person has a part that I don't have. So you find the mousy man married to the hysterical woman, right? She carries all the emotion for the relationship. He carries all the passivity for the relationship. That, or you get the fuser in the isolator. That's all part how it gets together. It only becomes unhealthy if people get stuck in the role and cannot move, change. Okay? There was a time, for instance, in our family, we always scapegoated our youngest son, Matthew. Well, being the youngest, and having there's myself, my wife, two older sisters, an older brother, who's the one to blame most frequently? The little one, right? Matthew did it. Well, Matthew learned how to talk and think. So what did Matthew do? He learned how to fault others, see? And so the blame never always just got onto Matthew. It got more distributed. And that's a healthy system, by the way. In all healthy systems, you distribute the anxiety. In unhealthy systems, I can tell you, I know it. I know when I have somebody coming in, I can tell they're in an unhealthy system because someone in the family has been over-focused on. Someone is always the scapegoat. Someone is always the fault. Someone is always the blame. Somebody is binding all the anxiety for everybody else. That's an unhealthy system. I'm going to deal with that in the next session in naming your ghost and baptizing your hopes. Any last questions? They even have discovered that with rats. If you put three rats together, one of the three will become the scapegoat. And then you take out all the scapegoated rats in different experience and put them together. All the scapegoated rats then find another scapegoated rat. We'll talk about that more. Thank you.